This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents A Memory of Light, Book 14 of The Wheel of Time, by Robert Jordan and Brendan Sanderson. Read for you by Michael Kramer and Kate Redding.
Chapter 7. Into the Thick of It. Elaine stepped out of the pavilion after the meeting and entered a grove of a dozen or so trees, and not just any trees. They were towering, healthy, huge-limbed, beautiful trees, hundreds of feet tall with massive trunks. The way she froze and gaped would have been embarrassing if everyone else hadn't been doing the same. She looked to the side, where Egwene stood, mouth open, as she stared up into the huge trees. The sun still shone above, but the green leaves shaded the area, explaining why the light had dimmed inside the tent.
"These trees," Perrin said, stepping forward and resting his hand on the thick ribbed bark. "I've seen great trees like this before. Inside a steading."
Elaine embraced the source. The glow of Sidar was there, a warmth alongside that of the sun. She breathed in the power, and was amused to notice that most of the women who could channel had done as she had, the moment a steading was mentioned. "Well, whatever Rand is now," Egwene said, folding her arms, "he can't just make steading appear." She seemed to find the thought comforting. "Where did he go?" Elaine asked.
"He strolled out there," Perrin said, waving toward the trees, "and vanished."
People were walking among the massive trunks, soldiers from the various camps staring upward. She heard a Shinaran talking to Lord Agolmar close by.
"We watched them grow, my lord. They burst from the ground. It took less than 5 minutes for them to become so tall. I swear it, my lord, or I may never draw blade again."
"All right," Elaine said, releasing the source. "Let's begin. Nations are burning. Maps.
We need maps."
The other rulers turned toward her. In the meeting with Rand standing there, few of them had objected to her being chosen to lead them. That was how it could be around him. A person was swept up in the tides of Rand's will. Things seemed so logical when he spoke of them. Many now looked displeased to have her put above them. Best to give them no time to dwell on it.
"Where is Master Nori?" she said to Dailin. "Could he have..."
"I have maps, Your Majesty,"
Gareth Bryn said as he left the pavilion, Swan at his side. He seemed grayer than she remembered him. He wore a stiff white coat and trousers, the breast marked with the flame of Tarvalon. He bowed in respect, but did not step too close. His uniform made his allegiance plain, as did Swan's protective hand on his arm. Elaine remembered him standing with that same quiet expression behind her mother, never presuming, always protecting the queen. That queen had put him out to pasture. That event hadn't been Elaine's fault, but she could read the breached trust in Bryn's face. Elaine could not change what had come and gone. She could look only to the future. "If you have maps of this area and the potential battlefields presented to us, Lord Bryn, we would love to see them. I would like maps for the area between here and Camelon, a detailed map of Kandor, and your best maps of the other borderland areas."
To the rulers she continued, "Gather your commanders and advisers. We must meet immediately with the other great captains to discuss our next course of action." It didn't take long, though the confusion was pervasive, as 2 dozen different factions set to work. Servants pulled open the sides of the pavilion, and Elaine ordered Sumeiko to gather kinswomen and guards to fetch tables and some chairs through a gateway from her camp. Elaine also sent for specific reports of what was happening at the Gap, where Rand had asked the bulk of the Borderlander armies to go and rescue Lan. The rulers and great captains had remained behind for the planning. Shortly, Elaine and Egwene stood surveying Bryn's detailed maps, which had been spread out across 4 tables. The rulers stood back and allowed the commanders to deliberate.
"This is good work, Bryn," Lord Agelmar said.
The Shinaran was one of the 4 remaining great captains. Bryn was another. The final 2 great captains, Davram Bashir and Rodol Iteralda, stood side by side at the end of another table, making corrections to a map of the western borderlands. Iteralda had bags under his eyes, and his hands sometimes shook. From what Elaine had heard, he had suffered quite an ordeal in Maradon, having been rescued only very recently. She was surprised he was here, actually. "All right," Elaine said to the assembly. "We must fight. But how? Where?"
"Large forces of Shadow Spawn have invaded 3 locations," Bryn said. "Caemlyn, Kandor, and Tarwyn's Gap. The Gap should not be abandoned, assuming our armies are enough to help Lord Mandragoran stabilize there. The likely result of our push there today will be the Shadow Spawn pulling back into the pass. Keeping the enemy plugged up there is an unsuitable task for the Malkieri heavy cavalry alone. Perhaps we would best send him some pike companies? If he continues to plug that breach, we can devote the majority of our forces to combat in Andor and Kandor."
Agelmar nodded.
"Yes, that should be viable if we give Dai Shan the proper support. But we cannot risk letting Shinar become overrun as Kandor was. If they push out of the Gap, we are prepared for an extended battle," Lord Isar said. "Kandor's resistance and Lan's fight at the Gap have given us the time we need. Our people are pulling into our fortresses. We can hold, even if we lose the Gap."
"Brave words, Your Majesty," Gareth Bryn said. "But it would be best if we did not have to test the Shinarans in that way. Let us plan to hold the Gap with whatever force it takes to do so."
"And Caemlyn?" Elaine asked. Iteralda nodded.
"An enemy force that deep behind our lines with a waygate to use for reinforcements? That is trouble."
"Early reports from this morning," Elaine said, "indicate they're staying put for the time being. They burned large quarters of the city but left other sections alone. And now that they have the city, the Trollocs have been set to work smothering the flames."
"They will have to leave eventually," Bryn said. "But it will be better if we can flush them out sooner, rather than later." "Why not consider a siege?" Agelmar asked. "I think the bulk of our armies should go to Kandor. I would not let the Throne of Clouds and the 3 Halls of Trade fall as did the 7 Towers."
"Kandor already has fallen," Prince Antol said softly.
The great captains looked at the eldest son of the Kandori queen. A tall man, he had a silent way about him. Now he spoke boldly.
"My mother fights for our country," he said, "but it is a fight of vengeance and redemption. Kandor burns, and it rips my heart to know it, but we cannot stop that. Give Andor your greatest attention. It is too tactically important to ignore, and I would not see another land fall as mine has."
The others nodded.
"Wise advice, Highness," Bashir said. "Thank you." "Also, do not forget Sheol Ghul," Ruark said from the periphery,
where he stood alongside Perrin, Samaiz Sedai, and several other Aiel chiefs.
The great captains turned toward Ruark, as if having forgotten he was there.
"The Karakarn soon will assault Sheol Ghul," Ruark said. "He will need spears at his back when he does so."
"He will have them," Elaine said. "Though that means four battlefronts. Sheol Ghul, Tarwyn's Gap, Kandor, and Camelin."
"Let us focus on Camelin first," Iteralda said. "I don't like the idea of a siege there. We need to flush the Trollocs out. If we simply besiege them, it gives them more time to reinforce their numbers through that waygate. We have to take them out now, on our terms."
Agilmar nodded with a grunt, looking at the map of Camelin an aide had put on the table.
"Can we stanch that flow? Retake the waygate?"
"I've tried," Elaine said. "This morning we sent three separate forces through a gateway into the basement with the waygate, but the shadow is prepared and entrenched. None of the forces returned. I don't know if we can take the waygate back, or even destroy it."
"What if we tried from the other side?" Agilmar asked.
"The other side?" Elaine asked. "You mean from inside the ways?" Agilmar nodded.
"Nobody travels the ways," Iteralda said, aghast.
"The Trollocs do," Agilmar said.
"I've been through them," Perrin said, approaching the table. "And I'm sorry, my lords, but I don't think that taking the waygate from the other side would work. From what I understand, we couldn't destroy it, even with the one power. And we couldn't hold it inside, not with the black wind in there. Our best choice is to somehow get those Trollocs out of Camelin and then hold this side of the waygate. If it is properly guarded, the Shadow would never be able to use it against us."
"Very well," Elaine said. "We will consider other options. Though it occurs to me that we should send to the Black Tower for their Ashaman also. How many are there?" Perrin cleared his throat.
"I think you might want to be careful about that place, Your Majesty. Something's going on there."
Elaine frowned. "Something?"
"I don't know," Perrin said. "I spoke to Rand about it, and he was worried and said he was going to investigate. Anyway, just be careful."
"I'm always careful," Elaine said absently. "So how do we get those Trollocs out of Camelin?"
"Perhaps we can hide a large assault force in Brame Wood. It's here, almost 50 leagues north of Camelin."
Bryn pointed at the map.
"If a smaller company of soldiers were to go up to the city gates and get the Trollocs to chase them back to the wood as bait in the trap. I always worried that an invading army would use the wood for cover as a base for attacking the city. I never thought I'd be considering the same option myself."
"Interesting," Agilmar said, studying a map of the terrain around Camelin. "That seems like a solid prospect."
"But what of Kandor?" Bashir asked. "The prince is right that the country is beyond rescue, but we cannot simply let the Trollocs pour out into other lands."
Iteralda scratched at his chin.
"This entire matter is going to be difficult. Three Trolloc armies, with us forced to divide our attention between them. Yes, more and more I realize that the right move is to focus on one of them and set delaying forces against the other two."
"The Shadow's army at Camelin is likely the smallest," Agilmar said, "as the size of the waygate has restricted their entry into the city."
"Yes," Bashir agreed. "Our chance for a quick victory on one of the battlefronts is best at Camelin. We should strike hard there with the largest of our assault forces. If we can win in Andor, it will reduce the number of fronts we have to fight on, and that will be extremely advantageous."
"Yes," Elaine said. "We reinforce Lan, but tell him that his job will be to hold there as long as he can. We place a second force at the border of Kandor with the purpose of delaying there as well, perhaps a slow withdrawal, as conditions dictate. While those two fronts are held, we can focus our true attention and our largest army at breaking the Trollocs in Camelin."
"Good," Agilmar said. "I like it. But what force do we place in Kandor?
What army can slow the Trollocs, but won't require a large commitment of troops?
The White Tower? Elaine asked. If we send the Aes Sedai to Kandor, they can slow the Trollocs' advance across the border. That will let the rest of us concentrate on Camelin.
Yes, Bryn said. I like it. And what of the fourth battlefront? Aetaralda asked. Shael Ghul? Does anyone know what the Lord Dragon plans there?
Nobody spoke.
The Aiel will see to his needs, Amys said from beside the clan chiefs. You needn't worry about us. Make your battle plans, and we will make ours.
No, Elaine said.
Elaine, Avienda said.
This is precisely what Rand wished to avoid, Elaine said forcefully. The Aiel will work with the rest of us. The battle at Shael Ghul could be the most important of all. I won't have one group presuming to keep to themselves and fight alone. You'll accept our help.
And, she added to herself, our direction.
The Aiel were excellent warriors, but there were some things they just wouldn't admit. The usefulness of cavalry, for one.
The Aiel obviously did not like the prospect of Wetlander command. They bristled, eyes narrowing.
The Aiel are excellent irregulars, Bryn said, looking to them. I faced you on the Bloodsnow, and I know how deadly you can be. However, if the Lord Dragon attacks Shael Ghul, we will likely need to seize the valley and then hold it for as long as it takes him to battle with the Dark One. I don't know how long that will take, but it could take hours, days. Tell me, have you ever had to entrench and fight a protracted defensive war? We will do what needs to be done, Ruark said.
Ruark, Elaine said. You yourselves insisted on signing the Dragon's Peace. You yourselves insisted that you be part of our coalition. I expect you to live up to your word. You will do as you are told.
Bryn's and Aetaralda's questions had set them off, but being told directly what to do made them back down.
Ruark nodded.
Of course, he said. I have to.
Meet it by listening, Elaine said, and offering your opinion. If we're going to fight on four different fronts at once, we'll need a lot of coordination.
She looked at the gathered generals. It occurs to me, we have four battle fronts, and four great captains.
Bashir nodded.
No coincidence, that.
Well, it might be one.
There are no coincidences, Highness, Bashir said. If I've learned one thing traveling with the Lord Dragon, that is it. Four of us, four battle fronts. We each take one, with Queen Elaine coordinating among us and overseeing the war effort as a whole. I will go to the Malkyrie, Agelmar said. Most of the Borderlanders fight there now.
What of Kandor? Elaine said.
If the Aes Sedai are to fight there, Bryn said, so will I. My place is with the White Tower.
He doesn't want to fight in Andor, Elaine thought. He doesn't want to fight alongside me. He wishes the break to be clean.
Who comes to Andor with me, then?
I'll go, Bashir said. And I to Shael Ghul, then, Aetaralda said, nodding. To fight alongside Aiel, a day I never thought I'd see, in truth.
Good, Elaine said, pulling over a chair. Then let's dig into the thick of it and get to details. We need a central location for me to work from, and Camelin is lost. For now I will use Merilor. It is central and has plenty of room to move troops and supplies around in. Perrin, do you think you could take charge of the logistics of this camp? Set up a traveling ground and organize the channelers to help with communications and supply operations?
Perrin nodded.
The rest of you, she said. Let's get to dividing the forces in detail and fleshing out the plans. We need a firm idea of how we are going to push those Trollocs out of Camelin, so we can fight them on even ground.
Hours later,
Elaine stepped from the pavilion, her mind spinning with details of tactics, supply needs, and troop placements. When she blinked, she could see maps in her mind's eye, covered with Garth Bryn's cramped notations. The others from the meeting began trailing away to their separate camps to begin executing their battle plans. The dimming sky had required lanterns to be set up around the pavilion. She vaguely remembered both lunch and dinner being brought to the meeting. She'd eaten, hadn't she? There had simply been so much to do. She nodded to those rulers who passed her, giving farewells. Most of the initial planning details had been worked out. On the morrow, Elaine would take her troops to Andor and begin the first leg of the counterattack against the Shadow. The ground here was now soft and springy with deep green grass. Rand's influence lingered, though he had departed. As Elaine inspected those towering trees, Garth Bryn stepped up beside her. She turned, surprised he hadn't left the pavilion already. The only ones still here now were the servants and Elaine's guards. "Lord Bryn?" she asked.
"I just wanted to say that I'm proud," Bryn told her softly. "You did well in there."
"I had hardly anything to add."
"You added leadership," Bryn said. "You aren't a general, Elaine, and nobody expects you to be one. But when Tenobia complained about Saldea being left exposed, you were the one who diverted her back to what matters. Tensions are high, but you kept us together, smoothed over bad feelings, prevented us from snapping at one another. Good work, Your Majesty. Very good work."
She grinned. Light, but it was hard not to positively beam at his words. He wasn't her father, but in many ways he was as close to one as she had. "Thank you. And Bryn, the Crown apologizes for—"
"Not a word of that," he said. "The wheel weaves as it wills. I don't blame Andor for what happened to me."
He hesitated.
"I'm still going to fight together with the White Tower, Elaine."
"I understand." He bowed to her and strode off toward Egwene's section of camp. Birgitta stepped up to Elaine. "Back to our camp, then?" the woman asked. Elaine hesitated, hearing something. A faint sound, yet somehow deep and powerful. She frowned, walking toward it, holding up a hand to still Birgitta as she started to ask what was happening. The two of them rounded the pavilion, crossing green grass and blossoming morning's breath, walking toward the sound, which grew stronger and stronger. A song, a beautiful song, unlike any she had ever heard, that made her tremble with its striking sonority. It washed over her, enveloped her, vibrated through her. A joyful song, a song of awe and wonder, though she could not understand the words. She approached a group of towering creatures, like trees themselves, standing with their hands on the gnarled trunks of the trees Rand had grown, their eyes closed. 3 dozen Ogier of various ages, from those with eyebrows as white as new snow to those as young as loyal. He stood there with them, a smile raising the sides of his mouth as he sang. Perrin, arms folded, stood nearby with his wife.
"Your talk of going to the Ashaman had me thinking. If we need allies, what about the Ogier? I was going to see if I could find Loyal, but before I could set out, I found them already here among these trees."
Elaine nodded, listening to the Ogier song reach its climax, then fade, the Ogier bowing their heads. For a moment, all was peaceful. Finally, an ancient Ogier opened his eyes and turned toward Elaine. His white beard reached low on his chest, below the white mustaches that drooped on either side of his mouth. He stepped forward, other ancients, both male and female, joining him. With them came Loyal.
You are the queen,
the ancient Ogier said, bowing to her.
The one who leads this journey. I am Haman, son of Dal, son of Morel. We have come to lend our axes to your fight.
I am pleased, Elaine said, nodding to him. 3 dozen Ogier will add strength to our battle.
3 dozen, young one?
Haman laughed a rumbling laugh.
The great stump did not meet, did not debate this long time to send you 3 dozen of our numbers. The Ogier will fight alongside humans. All of us. Every one of us who can hold an axe or long knife.
Wonderful, Elaine said. I will put you to good use. An older Ogier woman shook her head.
So hasty. So quick. Know this, young one. There were some who would have abandoned you and the world to the shadow.
Elaine blinked in shock. You would have actually done it? Just left us alone? To fight?
Some argued for it,
Haman said.
I myself took that position, the woman said. I made the argument, though I did not truly believe it was right.
What?
Loyal asked, stumbling forward. This seemed news to him.
You didn't?
The woman looked to him.
Trees will not grow if the Dark One claims this world.
Loyal looked surprised.
But why did you?
An argument must have opposition, if it is to prove itself, my son, she said. One who argues truly learns the depth of his commitment through adversity. Did you not learn that trees grow roots most strongly when winds blow through them?
She shook her head, though she did seem fond.
That is not to say you should have left the steading when you did. Not alone. Fortunately, that has been taken care of.
Taken care of? Perrin asked. Loyal blushed.
Well, you see, Perrin, I am married now.
You didn't mention this earlier.
Everything has come so quickly. I am married to Aerith, though, you see. She's just over there. Did you hear her singing? Isn't her song beautiful? Being married is not so bad, Perrin. Why didn't you tell me it was not so bad? I think I'm rather fond of it.
I am pleased for you, Loyal, Elaine cut in. Ogier could talk quite long on tangents if one was not careful. And thankful to all of you for joining us.
It is worth the price, perhaps,
Haman said.
Just to see these trees. In all my life, men have only cut great trees to see someone growing them instead. We made the correct decision. Yes, yes, we did. The others will need to see this.
Loyal waved to Perrin, apparently wanting to catch up.
Allow me to borrow him for a moment, Loyal, Elaine said, steering Perrin toward the center of the grove. Fael and Birgitta joined her, and Loyal waited behind. He seemed distracted by the mighty trees.
I have a duty I want to assign you, Elaine said softly to Perrin. Losing Camelin threatens to send our armies into a supply crisis. Despite complaints of food prices, we had been keeping everyone fed, as well as accumulating stores for the battle ahead. Those stores are now gone.
What of Kyrian?
Perrin asked. It still has some food, Elaine said. As do the White Tower and Tyr.
Bearlon has good supplies of metals and powder. I need to find what we can draw from the other nations and discover their food situation. It will be a massive task to coordinate stores and rations for all the armies. I'd like one person in charge of it all.
You were thinking of me?
Perrin said. Yes.
I'm sorry, Perrin said. Elaine, Rand needs me.
Rand needs us all.
He needs me more, Perrin said. Min saw it, he said. Without me at the last battle, he'll die. Besides, I have a few fights to finish.
I'll do it, Fael said. Elaine turned toward her, frowning. It is my duty to manage the affairs of my husband's army, Fael said. You are his liege, lady, your majesty, so your needs are his needs. If Andor is to command the last battle, then the two rivers will see it fed. Give me access to gateways large enough for wagons to drive through. Give me troops to protect my movements. And give me access to the quartermaster records of anyone I want. I will see it done. It was logical and rational, but not what Elaine needed. How far did she trust this woman? Fael had proven herself deft at politics. That was useful. But did she really consider herself part of Andor? Elaine studied the woman.
There is nobody better you can trust with this task, Elaine,
Perrin said.
Fael will see it done.
Perrin, Elaine said, there is a different matter involved in this. May we speak privately for a moment?
I'll just tell her what it is when we're done, Your Majesty, Perrin said. I don't keep secrets from my wife.
Fael smiled. Elaine eyed the two of them, then sighed softly. Egwene came to me during our battle preparations. There is a certain item of importance to the last battle that she needs to be delivered.
The Horn of Valir, Perrin said. You still have it, I hope.
We do, in the tower, hidden. We moved it from the strong room none too quickly. Last night that room was broken into. I know only because of certain wards we set. The Shadow knows we have the Horn, Perrin, and the Dark One's minions are looking for it. They can't use it. It's tied to Matt until he dies. But if the Shadow's minions can capture it, he can keep Matt from using it. Or worse, kill him, then blow it themselves. You want to mask moving it, Fael said. Using the supply runs to hide where you're taking it. We'd rather just give it to Matt straight out, Elaine said. But he can be difficult sometimes. I had hoped he would be here at this meeting.
He's in Abu Dhar, Perrin said, doing something with the Seanchan.
He told you? Elaine asked.
Not exactly, Perrin said, looking uncomfortable. We have some kind of connection. I sometimes see where he is and what he's doing.
That man, Elaine said, is never where he needs to be.
And yet, Perrin said, he always arrives there eventually.
The Seanchan are the enemy, Elaine said. Matt doesn't seem to understand that, considering what he's done. Light, I hope that man isn't putting himself in trouble somehow. I will do this, Fael said. I'll care for the Horn of Valir. I'll see it gets to Matt. Guard it. No offense to either of you, Elaine said. But I am hesitant to trust this to someone I don't know well. That is why I came to you, Perrin.
That's going to be a problem, Elaine, Perrin said. If they really are watching for the Horn, then they'll expect you and Egwene to give it to someone you know well. Choose Fael. There is nobody I trust more than her, but she won't be suspected, as she has no direct relationship with the White Tower.
Elaine nodded slowly. Very well. I'll send word to you on how it will be delivered. For now, begin running supplies to establish precedent. Too many people know about the horn. After we give it to you, I will send 5 suspect envoys from the White Tower and seed the right rumors. We hope that the Shadow will assume the horn is being carried by one of those envoys. I want it to be where nobody expects, at least until we can put it into Matrim's hands.
4 battlefronts, Lord Mandragoran, Bullen repeated. That's what the messengers are saying. Camlan, Sheol Ghul, Kandor, and here. They want to try to bottle up the Trollocs here and in Kandor while trying hard to defeat those in Andor first. Lan grunted, guiding Mandob around the reeking heap of dead Trollocs. The carcasses served as a bulwark now that his 5 Ashaman had pushed them up into mounds like dark, bloody hills before the Blight, where the Shadow Spawn gathered. The stench was horrible, of course. Many of the guards he passed in his rounds had thrown sprig leaf onto their fires to cover up the smell. Evening approached, bringing its most dangerous hours. Fortunately, those black clouds above made nights so dark that Trollocs had trouble seeing anything. Dusk, however, was a time of strength to them, a time when the eyes of humans were hampered but the eyes of the Shadow Spawn were not. The power of the United Borderlander attack had pushed the Trollocs back toward the mouth of the gap. Lan was getting reinforced by the hour with pikemen another foot to help him hold position. All in all, it looked far better here now than it had just a day before. Still grim, though. If what Bullen said was right, his army would be stationed here as a stalling force. That meant fewer troops for him than he would have liked. He could not fault the tactics presented, however. Lan passed into the area where the Shinaran lancers cared for their horses. A figure emerged from them and rode up beside Lan. King Isar was a compact man with a white topknot, recently arrived from the field of Marilor following a long day making battle plans. Lan began a horseback bow, but stopped as King Isar bowed to him.
"Your Majesty?" Lan asked.
"Aglamar has brought his plans for this battlefront, Daishan," King Isar said, falling in beside him. "He would like to go over them with us. It is important that you are there. We fight beneath the banner of Malkir. We all agreed to it."
"Tenobia?" Lan asked, genuinely surprised.
"In her case, a little encouragement was required. She came around. I also have word that Queen Atheniella will leave Kandor and come here. The Borderlands fight together in this battle, and we do it with you at our head." They rode on in the fading light, row upon row of lancers saluting Isar. The Shinarans were the finest heavy cavalry in the world, and they had fought and died upon these rocks countless times, defending the lush lands to the south.
"I will come," Lan agreed. "The weight of what you have given me feels like 3 mountains."
"I know," Isar said. "But we shall follow you, Daishan. Until the sky is rent asunder, until the rocks split underfoot, and until the wheel itself stops turning. Or light send its blessing until every sword is favored with peace."
"What of Kandor? If the Queen comes here, who will lead that battle?"
"The White Tower rides to fight the Shadowspawn there," Isar said. "You raised the Golden Crane. We were sworn to come to your aid, so we have." He hesitated, and then his voice grew grim.
"Kandor is beyond recovery now, Daishan. The Queen admits it. The White Tower's job is not to recover it, but to stop the Shadowspawn from taking more territory."
They turned and rode through the ranks of lancers. The men were required to spend dusk within a few paces of their mounts, and they made themselves busy caring for armor, weapons, and horses. Each man wore a long sword, sometimes 2, strapped to his back, and all had maces and daggers at their belts. The Shinarans did not rely solely upon their lances. An enemy who thought to pin them without room to charge soon discovered that they could be very dangerous in close quarters. Most of the men wore yellow surcoats over their plate and mail, bearing the Black Hawk. They gave their salutes with stiff backs and serious faces. Indeed, the Shinarans were a serious people. Living in the borderlands did that. Lan hesitated, then spoke in a loud voice.
"Why do we mourn?" The soldiers nearby turned toward him. "Is this not what we have trained for?" Lan shouted. "Is this not our purpose? Our very lives? This war is not a thing to mourn. Other men may have been lax, but we have not been. We are prepared. So this is a time of glory. Let there be laughter. Let there be joy. Let us cheer the fallen and drink to our forefathers who taught us well. If you die on the morrow, awaiting your rebirth, be proud. The last battle is upon us, and we are ready."
Lan wasn't sure exactly what had made him say it. His words inspired a round of, "Darshan, Darshan, forward the golden crane." He saw that some of the men were writing the speech down to pass among the other men.
"You do have the soul of a leader, Darshan," Isar said as they rode on. "It is not that," Lan said, eyes forward. "I cannot stand self-pity. Too many of the men looked as if they were preparing their own shrouds." "A drum with no head," Isar said softly, flicking his horse's reins. "A pump with no grip. A song with no voice. Still it is mine. Still it is mine."
Lan turned, frowning, but the king gave no explanation for the poem. If his people were a serious people, their king was more so. Isar had wounds deep within that he chose not to share. Lan did not fault him in this. Lan himself had done the same. Tonight, however, he caught Isar smiling as he considered whatever it was that had brought the poem to his lips.
"Was that an Asai of Riddingwood?" Lan asked.
Isar looked surprised.
"You have read Anasai's work?" "She was a favorite of Maureen Sedai. It sounded as though it might be hers." "Each of her poems was written as an elegy," Isar said. "This was for her father. She left instructions. It can be read, but should not be spoken out loud, except when it was right to do so. She did not explain when it would be right to do so."
They reached the war tents and dismounted. No sooner had they done so, however, than the horns of alarm began to sound. Both men reacted, and Lan unconsciously touched the sword on his hip.
"Let us go to Lord Agomar,"
Lan shouted as men began to yell and equipment to rattle.
"If you fight beneath my banner, then I will accept the role of leader gladly." "No hesitation at all?" Isar said. "What am I?" Lan asked, swinging into the saddle. "Some sheepherder from a forgotten village? I will do my duty. If men are foolish enough to put me in charge of them, I'll send them about theirs as well."
Isar nodded, then saluted, the corners of his mouth rising in another smile. Lan returned the salute, then galloped Mandarb through the center of the camp. The men at the outskirts were lighting bonfires. Ashaman had created gateways to one of the many dying forests in the south for soldiers to gather wood. If Lan had his way, those five channelers would never waste their strength killing Trollocs. They were far too useful otherwise. Narishma saluted Lan as he passed. Lan could not be certain that the great captains had chosen Borderlander Ashaman for him on purpose, but it seemed not to be a coincidence. He had at least one from each Borderlander nation, even one born to Melchieri parents.
"We fight together."
Chapter 8. That Smoldering City. Atop Moonshadow, her deep brown mare from the royal stables, Elaine Trakand rode through a gateway of her own making. Those stables were now in the hands of Trollocs, and Moonshadow's stablemates had undoubtedly found their way into cookpots by now. Elaine did not think too hard about what else, who else, might have ended up in those same pots. She set her face in determination.
her troops would not see their queen look uncertain. She had chosen to come to a hill about 1,000 paces to the northwest of Camelin, well out of bow range, but close enough to see the city. Several mercenary bands had made their camp in these hills during the weeks following the Succession War. Those had all either joined the armies of light or had disbanded, becoming roving thieves and brigands. The foreguard had already secured the area, and Captain Gaibon saluted as members of the Queen's Guard, both male and female, surrounded Elaine's horse. The air still smelled of smoke, and seeing Camelin smoldering like Dragonmount itself, tossed a handful of bitter powder into the stew of emotions churning inside of her. The once proud city was dead, a pyre that pitched 100 different columns of smoke toward the storm clouds above. The smoke reminded her of the spring burnings, when farmers would occasionally fire their fields to help clear them for planting. She hadn't ruled Camelin for 100 days, and already it was lost. If dragons can do that to a city, she thought, surveying the hole that Talmanis had made in the nearest wall, the world will need to change. Everything we know about warfare will change. How many, would you say? She asked the man who rode up beside her. Talmanis was only 1 day of rest away from the ordeal that should have cost him his life. He probably should have remained at Merilor. He certainly wouldn't be doing any frontline fighting in the near future.
It is impossible to count their numbers, hidden as they are in the city, Your Majesty, he said, bowing respectfully. Tens of thousands, but probably not hundreds of thousands.
The fellow was nervous around her, and he manifested it in a very Kyrianan way, by speaking with flowery respect. He was said to be one of Matt's most trusted officers. She would have assumed that by now Matt would have corrupted the fellow far more. He didn't curse once. Pity. Other gateways opened nearby onto the yellow grass, and her forces came through, filling the field and topping the hills. She had taken charge of a large army of warriors, which included many of the Siswai Aman, to bolster her queen's guard and the Andoran regulars under the command of Birgitta and Captain Gaibon. A second contingent of Aiel, maidens, wise ones, and the remaining warriors, had been chosen to travel north to Shael Ghul with Rand. Only a handful of wise ones had come with Elaine, the ones who followed Perrin. Elaine would have liked more channelers than that. Still, she did have the band and their dragons, which should make up for the fact that her only other channelers were the kinswomen, many of whom were on the weaker side of strength in the power. Perrin and his force had come with her. That included Mayenne's winged guards, the Gildanin cavalry, the white cloaks. She still wasn't sure what she thought of that, and a company of Two Rivers archers with Tam. Filling out her army was the group who called themselves the Wolf Guard, mostly refugees turned soldiers, some of whom had received combat training. And of course she had Captain Bashir and his Legion of the Dragon. She had approved Bashir's plan for the battle at Camelin.
We will need to draw the fighting into the woods, he had explained. The archers will be deadly, loosing at the Trollocs upon their approach. If these lads can move as well as I am told they can in the forest, they'll be just as dangerous once they've pulled back.
The Aiel, too, would be deadly in a forest, where the Trollocs wouldn't be able to use their masses to overrun their opponents. Bashir himself rode nearby. Apparently Rand had specifically told him to watch over her, as if she didn't have Birgitta jumping every time she moved. Rand had better stay safe, so I can tell him what I think of him, she thought, as Bashir approached in quiet conversation with Birgitta. Bashir was a bow-legged man with a thick mustache. He didn't talk to Elaine the way a man should a queen, but then the Queen of Saldea was his niece, so perhaps he was just very comfortable around royalty. He is first in line for the throne,
Elaine reminded herself. Working with him would offer opportunities to further secure her ties to Saldaea. She still liked the idea of seeing one of her children on that throne. She lowered a hand to her stomach. The babes kicked and elbowed frequently now. Nobody had told her it would feel so much like, well, indigestion. Unfortunately, Melfane had, against all expectation, found some goat's milk. "What word?" Elaine asked, as Birgitta and Bashir arrived, Talmanis moving his horse aside to make room.
"Scout reports of the city are in," Bashir said.
"Bashir was right," Birgitta said. "The Trollocs have been reined in, and the burning has mostly died out. A good half of the city still stands. Much of that smoke you see is from cook fires, not buildings."
"Trollocs are stupid," Bashir said, "but half-men are not. The Trollocs would have gleefully ransacked the city and lit fires all across it, but that would have threatened to let the fires get away from them. Either way, the truth is we don't know what the Shadow is planning here, but they at least have the option of trying to hold the city for a time, should they desire."
"Will they try that?" Elaine asked.
"I can't say, honestly," Bashir replied. "We don't know their goals. Was this attack on Camelin intended to sow chaos and bring fear to our armies? Or is it intended to take a stronghold and hold it long-term as a base from which to harry our forces? Back during the Trolloc Wars, the Fades did hold cities for that purpose."
Elaine nodded.
"Pardon, Your Majesty," a voice said.
She turned to see one of the Two Rivers men stepping up. One of their leaders, Tam's second-in-command. Danil, she thought, that's his name.
"Your Majesty," Danil repeated.
He fumbled a bit, but actually spoke with some polish.
"Lord Goldeneyes has his men set up in the forest."
"Lord Talmanis, do you have your dragons in position?"
"Almost," Talmanis said. "Pardon, Your Majesty, but I'm not certain the bows will be needed once those weapons fire. Are you certain you don't want to lead with the dragons?"
"We need to goad the Trollocs into battle," Elaine said. "The placement I outlined will work best. Bashir, what of my plan for the city itself?"
"I think everything is almost ready, but I'll want to check," Bashir said, knuckling his mustache in thought. "Those women of yours made gateways well enough, and Mayen gave us the oil. You're sure you want to go through with something so drastic?"
"Yes." Bashir waited for more of a response, perhaps an explanation. When she didn't give one, he moved off, issuing the last orders. Elaine turned Moonshadow to ride down the ranks of soldiers here at the front lines, where they'd be set up near the forests. There wasn't much she could do now, in these last moments, as her commanders gave orders, but she could be seen riding with confidence. Where she passed, the men raised their pikes higher, lifted their chins. Elaine kept her own eyes on that smoldering city. She would not look away, and she would not let anger control her. She would use the anger. Bashir returned to her a short time later.
"It's done. The basements of many buildings that are still standing have been filled with oil. Talmanis and the others are in place. Once your warder returns with word that the kinswomen are prepared to open another round of gateways, we can proceed."
Elaine nodded, and then removed her hand from her belly as Bashir glanced at it. She hadn't realized she'd been holding it again. "What do you think of me going into battle while pregnant? Is it a mistake?" He shook his head.
"No. It proves just how desperate our situation is. It will make the soldiers think. Make them more serious. Besides..."
"What?"
Bashir shrugged. "Perhaps it will remind them that not everything in this world is dying."
Elaine turned back, looking at the distant city. Farmers burned their fields in the spring to prepare them for new life. Maybe that was what Andor was suffering now.
"Tell me," Bashir said.
Are you going to tell the men that you're carrying the Lord Dragon's child?
Children, Elaine corrected in her head. You presume to know something that may or may not be true, Lord Bashir.
I have a wife and a daughter. I recognize the look in your eyes when you see the Lord Dragon. No woman with child touches her hand to her womb so reverently when looking on a man who is not the father.
Elaine drew her lips into a line.
Why do you hide it?
Thing that may or may not be true, Lord Bashir.
I have a wife and a daughter. I recognize the look in your eyes when you see the Lord Dragon. No woman with child touches her hand to her womb so reverently when looking on a man who is not the father.
Elaine drew her lips into a line.
Why do you hide it? Bashir asked. I've heard what some of the men think. They talk of some other man, a dark friend named Melar, once captain of your guardswomen. I can see that the rumors are false, but others are not so wise. You could kill those rumors if you wished.
Rand's children will be targets, she said.
Ah, he replied.
He knuckled his mustache for a moment.
If you disagree with the reasoning, Bashir, speak your mind. I will not suffer a toady. I'm no toady, woman, he said with a huff. But regardless, I hardly doubt your child could be a greater target than he or she already is. You're high commander of the armies of the light. I think your men deserve to know what exactly they're fighting for.
It is not your business to know, Elaine said. Nor is it theirs. Bashir raised an eyebrow at her.
The heir to the realm, he said flatly, is not the business of its subjects.
I believe you are overstepping your bounds, General.
Perhaps I am, he said. Maybe spending so much time with the Lord Dragon has warped the way I do things. That man, he could never tell what he was thinking. Half of the time he wanted to hear my mind as raw as I could lay it out. The other half of the time it seemed like he'd break me in two just for commenting that the sky looked a little dark.
Bashir shook his head.
Just give it some thought, Your Majesty. You remind me of my daughter. She might have done something similar, and this is the advice I'd give her. Your men will fight more bravely if they know that you carry the Dragon Reborn's heir.
Men, Elaine thought. The young ones try to impress me with every stunt that comes into their fool heads. The old ones assume every young woman is in need of a lecture. She turned her eyes toward the city again as Birgitta rode up and gave her a nod. The basements were filled with oil and pitch.
Burn it, Elaine said loudly.
Birgitta waved a hand. The kinswomen opened their round of gateways, and men hurled lit torches through into the basements of Camelin. It didn't take long for the smoke rising above the city to grow darker, more ominous.
They won't soon put that out, Birgitta said softly. Not with the dry weather we've been having. The entire city will go up like a haystack.
The army gathered to stare at the city, particularly the members of the Queen's Guard and the Andoran military. A few of them saluted, as one might salute the pyre of a fallen hero. Elaine ground her teeth, then said, Birgitta, make it known among the guards. The children I carry were fathered by the Dragon Reborn.
Bashir's smile deepened.
Insufferable man! Birgitta was smiling as she went to spread the word. She was insufferable, too. The men of Andor seemed to stand taller, prouder, as they watched their capital burn. Trollocs started pouring from the gates, driven by the fires. Elaine made sure the Trollocs saw her army, then announced,
Northward! She turned Moonshadow. Camelin is dead! We take to the forests. Let the shadow spawn follow.
Andral awoke with dirt in his mouth. He groaned, trying to roll over, but found himself bound in some way.
He spat, licked his lips, and blinked crusty eyes. He lay with Jonath and Amarin against an earthen wall, tied by ropes. He remembered light. The roof had fallen in. "Pavara," he sent. Incredible how natural that method of communication was beginning to feel. He was rewarded with a groggy sensation from her. The bond let him know that she was nearby, probably tied up as well. The one power was also lost to him. He clawed at it, but ran up against a shield. His bonds were tied to some kind of hook in the ground behind him, hindering his movement. Anvil shoved panic down with some effort. He couldn't see Nelam. Was he here? The group of them lay tied in a large chamber, and the air smelled of damp earth. They were still underground in a part of Taim's secret complex. If the roof fell in, Andral thought, the cells were probably destroyed. That explained why he and the others were tied up but not locked away. Someone was sobbing. He strained around and found Evan tied nearby. The younger man wept, shaking. "It's all right, Evan," Andral whispered. "We'll find a way out of this." Evan glanced at him, shocked. The youth was tied in a different way, in a seated position, hands behind his back.
"Andral. Andral, I'm sorry."
Andral felt a twisting emotion.
"For what, Evan?" "They came right after the rest of you left. They wanted Amarin, I think, to turn him. When he wasn't there, they began asking questions, demands. They broke me, Andral. I broke so easily. I'm sorry."
So Taim hadn't discovered the fallen guards.
"It's not your fault, Evan."
Footsteps sounded on the ground nearby. Andral feigned unconsciousness, but someone kicked him.
"I saw you talking, page boy," Mishrael said, leaning down his golden-haired head.
"I'm going to enjoy killing you for what you did to Kotaran."
Andral opened his eyes and saw Loghain sagging in the grip of Mezar and Welen. They dragged him near and dropped him roughly to the ground. Loghain stirred and groaned as they tied him up. They stood and one spat on Andral before moving over to Amarin.
"No," Taim said from somewhere near. "The youth is next. The Great Lord demands results. Loghain is taking too long."
Evan's sobs grew louder as Mezar and Welen moved over to seize him under the arms.
"No,"
Andral said, twisting.
"No! Taim, burn you! Leave him alone! Take me!"
Taim stood nearby, hands clasped behind his back, in a sharp black uniform that resembled those of the Ashaman but trimmed with silver. He wore no pins at his neck. He turned toward Andral, then sneered.
"Take you? I am to present to the Great Lord a man who can't channel enough to break a pebble? I should have culled you long ago."
Taim followed the other two, who were dragging away the frantic Evan. Andral screamed at them, yelling until he was hoarse. They took Evan somewhere on the other side of the chamber. It was very large, and Andral could not see them because of the angle at which he was tied. Andral dropped his head back against the floor, closing his eyes. That didn't prevent him from hearing poor Evan's screams of terror.
"Andral," Pivara whispered.
"Quiet!"
Mishrael's voice was followed by a thump and a grunt from Pivara.
"I am really starting to hate that one," Pivara sent to him.
Andral didn't reply.
"They took the effort to dig us out of the collapsed room," Pivara continued. "I remember some of it, before they shielded me and knocked me unconscious. It seems to have been less than a day since then. I guess Taim hasn't yet hit his quota of dreadlords turned to the shadow."
She sent it, almost with levity. Behind them, Evan's screams stopped.
"Oh, light," Pivara sent. "Was that Evan?"
All wryness vanished from her tone.
"What's happening?"
"They're turning him," Andral sent back.
Strength of will has something to do with resisting. That is why Loghain hasn't been turned yet. Pevara's concern was a warmth through the bond. Were all Aes Sedai like her? He'd assumed they had no emotions, but Pevara felt the full range, although she accompanied it with an almost inhuman control over how those emotions affected her. Another result of decades of practice? How do we escape? She sent. I'm trying to untie my bonds. My fingers are stiff. I can see the knot. It's a hefty one, but I might be able to guide you. He nodded, and they began, Pevara describing the turns of the knot as Andril tried to twist his fingers around them. He failed to get enough purchase on the bonds. He tried pulling his hands free and wiggling them out, but the ropes were too tight. By the time he accepted defeat, his fingers were numb from the lack of circulation. It's not going to work, he sent. I've been trying to push out of this shield, Pevara replied. It's possible, and I think our shields might be tied off. Tied off shields fail. Andril sent back agreement, though he couldn't keep from feeling frustrated. How long could Evan hold out? The silence taunted him. Why couldn't he hear any sounds? Then he sensed something. Channeling. Could that be 13 men? Light. If there were 13 Murdrall as well, the situation was dire. What would they do if they escaped? They couldn't fight so many. Which cliff did you choose? Pevara sent him. What? You said that when you were among the sea folk, they jumped off cliffs to prove their bravery. The higher the cliff, the braver the jumper. Which cliff did you choose? The highest, he admitted. Why? I figured that once you've decided to jump off a cliff, you might as well pick the highest one. Why accept the risk if not for the greatest prize? Pevara sent back approval. We will escape, Andral. Somehow. He nodded, mostly for himself, and set back at his knot. A few moments later, Taim's cronies returned. Evan squatted down beside Andral. Behind his eyes lurked something different, something awful. He smiled. Well, that was certainly not as bad as I had assumed it would be, Andral. Oh, Evan. Don't worry about me, Evan said, resting a hand on Andral's shoulder. I feel great. No more fear, no more worry. We shouldn't have been fighting all of this time. We are the Black Tower. We need to work together. You are not my friend, Andral thought. You might have his face, but Evan, oh light, Evan is dead. Where is Nalam? Andral asked. Died in the cave-in, I'm afraid. Evan shook his head. He leaned in. They're planning to kill you, Andral, but I think I can convince them that you're worth turning instead. You'll thank me eventually. The terrible thing inside of Evan's eyes smiled, patted Andral on the shoulder, then rose and began chatting with Mezar and Wellen. Behind them, Andral could barely see 13 shadows trailing over to grab Imaran and drag him away to be turned next. Fades, with cloaks that did not move. Andral thought how lucky Nalam was to be crushed in the collapse. Chapter 9. To Die Well. Lan split the head of the Murdrall in half down to the neck. He danced Mandar back, letting the fade thrash as it died, its convulsions twisting the pieces of its skull from the neck. Putrid black blood poured onto the rock, which had already been bloodied a dozen times. Lord Mandragoran! Lan wheeled toward the call. One of his men pointed back toward their camp, where a spout of bright red light was shooting into the air. Noon already? Lan thought, raising his sword and signaling for his Melchieri to retreat. The Kandore and Arafelan troops were swinging in, light cavalry with bows sending wave after wave of arrows into the mass of Trollocs. The stench was tremendous. Lan and his men rode away from the front lines, passing two Ashaman and an Aes Sedai, Koladera, who had insisted on staying on as King Pytar's advisor, channeling to set the Trolloc corpses aflame. That would make it more difficult for the next wave of Shadowspawn. Lan's armies had continued their brutal work, holding the Trollocs at the gap like pitch holding back the spray of water in a leaking boat. The army fought in short rotations, an hour at a time. Bonfires and Ashaman lit the way at night, never giving the Shadowspawn the opportunity to advance. After 2 days of grueling battle, Lan knew that this tactic would eventually favor the Trollocs. Humans were killing them by the wagon load, but the Shadow had been building its forces for years. Each night the Trollocs fed upon the dead. They didn't have to worry about mess supplies. Lan kept his shoulders from sagging as he rode away from the front lines, making way for the next group of his troops, but he wanted to collapse and sleep for days. Despite the greater numbers given him by the Dragon Reborn, every man was required to take several shifts on the front lines each day. Lan always joined a few extra. Finding sleep was not easy for his troops, while also caring for their equipment, gathering wood for the bonfires, and bringing supplies through gateways. As he surveyed those leaving the front lines with him, Lan sought for what he could do to strengthen them. Nearby, faithful Bulan was sagging. Lan would need to make sure the man slept more, or... Bulan slid from the saddle. Lan cursed, stopping Mandarb, and leaped down. He dashed to Bulan's side and found the man staring blankly into the sky. Bulan had a massive wound in his side, the mail there ripped like a sail that had seen too much wind. Bulan had covered the wound by putting his coat on over his armor. Lan hadn't seen him hit, nor had he seen the man covering up the wound. "Fool," Lan thought, feeling at Bulan's neck. No pulse. He was gone. "Fool," Lan thought again, bowing his head.
"You wouldn't leave my side, would you? That's why you hit it. You were afraid I'd die out there while you came back for healing. Either that or you didn't want to demand strength from the channelers. You knew they were pushed to their limits."
With teeth clenched, Lan picked up Bulan's corpse and slung it over his shoulder. He hefted the body onto Bulan's horse and tied it across the saddle. Andir and Prince Kaisel, the Kandori youth and his squad of 100 usually rode with Lan, sat nearby, watching solemnly. Conscious of their eyes, Lan put his hand on the corpse's shoulder.
"You did well, my friend," he said. "Your praises will be sung for generations. May you shelter in the palm of the Creator's hand, and may the last embrace of the Mother welcome you home."
He turned to the others.
"I will not mourn. Mourning is for those who regret, and I do not regret what we do here. Bulan could not have died a better death. I do not cry for him. I cheer."
He swung up into Mandarb's saddle, holding the reins of Bulan's horse, and sat tall. He would not let them see his fatigue, or his sorrow.
"Did any of you see Bok fall?" he asked those riding near him. "He had a crossbow tied to the back of his horse. He always carried that thing with him. I swore that if it ever went off by accident, I'd have the Ashaman hang him by his toes from the top of a cliff. He died yesterday when his sword caught in a Trolloc's armor. He left it and reached for his spear, but two more Trollocs pulled his horse out from underneath him. I thought he was dead then, and was trying to reach him, only to see him come up with that light-burned crossbow of his, and shoot a Trolloc right in the eye from 2 feet away. The bolt went clear through its head. The second Trolloc gutted him, but not before he put his boot knife in its neck."
Lan nodded.
"I remember you, Bok. You died well."
They rode for a few moments, and then Prince Kaisel added,
"Ragan, he died well, too. Charged his horse straight at a group of 30 Trollocs that were coming in at us from the side. Probably saved a dozen men with that move, buying us time. He kicked one in the face as they pulled him down. Yes, Ragan was a right insane man,"
Andir said.
"I'm one of the men he saved.